Hello and welcome to the Painting Podcast. I'm your host, Jeremiah Polacek, your co-pilot on the pathway to becoming a better painter, or maybe just a better art lover in general. Today we're going to be talking about isolation and its relation to the creative process. How does isolation influence the creative process? In what ways do you think isolation challenges an artist? In what ways do you think it might benefit them? We're going to get into these topics and more, so stick around. Let's get into it. The concept of an artist slaving away in a garret is a romanticized and often misunderstood stereotype that has been popularized through literature, film, and other forms of cultural expression throughout the years. It's something we see all the time, and this image typically portrays an artist as a solitary genius, and they're working in a small, cramped attic, or, you know, they're living in poor conditions, and they're sacrificing their social life and their physical well-being for the sake of their art. This is kind of the picture, the stereotype that we have of artists, and it still exists to this day. And the reality of artists' lives and their creative process is a lot more nuanced and diverse than this stereotype would suggest. So I'm by no means saying that this stereotype is the norm, nor should it be something that we seek to achieve in our artistic practice, right? However, with that being said, we've still encountered a lot of artists throughout the ages who've been isolated. And in this podcast, I'm looking to examine how their isolation influenced their work and their creative process. And I think this is also something that a lot of people experienced through the lockdowns of 2020 and 2021. A lot of people experienced isolation in certain ways. They were socially isolated. Of course, you know, there was technology bridging a lot of the gaps in many cases. But in my own personal case, I was actually living in my studio at the University of Colorado, in the studio there. And so when they locked down the building, I lost access to where I was living as well. So I had to drive like 15 hours from Boulder, and I drove to Bismarck, North Dakota, and I stayed on my family's farm all day, every day, and I was there painting. Basically, you know, in this environment that most would consider, you know, isolation. And that's where a lot of the seeds for this investigation were planted. And in thinking about my own isolation and how it affected my work, I sought to look at other artists who have also dealt with isolation and how that affected the way they saw the world and the way that they created too. So to start things off, I think it's important to define isolation specifically in the context of visual arts and how things like solitude, separation, and introspection are represented. And I think thematically, as a method or as an experiential condition that exists for an artist, that isolation can manifest in a lot of different ways and in a lot of different dimensions within the visual arts. And the first thing I'd like to look at is isolation in terms of thematic representation. So we can be creating things that exude this sense of isolation. I did another episode on Caspar David Friedrich, and you can listen to that. But he was, you know, he was a romantic, and he was also known as somebody who would go on walks by himself. He was very introspective, but he also made paintings where often there was only a solitary figure in the frame. So when we have somebody by themselves, we immediately kind of get this idea of isolation and introspection, which is present in the creation of the painting itself. So we can think about isolation in relation to what I would call thematic representation. What is the subject matter and how is it depicting a scene that, you know, exudes loneliness, solitude, desolation, these types of things. The second type of isolation I'd like to talk about would be a methodological isolation. And what I mean by that would be that an artist may choose to physically isolate themselves from society. And the goal of doing this would be to dive deeper into their own creative process. And the belief is that this approach can foster this unique self-reflective or a kind of meditative state, and that's going to fuel creativity. That's going to be the gasoline for the artwork to burn brightly, right? Then there's also the idea of conceptual solitude. And this is isolation as a method that might involve focusing on, you know, like a singular isolated subject or theme repeatedly and exploring them over and over and over again from multiple angles. And this is going to create a comprehensive body of work that can, you know, be a deeper dive into specific experiences or emotions. So we isolate our concepts. We focus on one concept in and of itself. And that can be a type of conceptual solitude or isolation in that respect. I think there's also some psychological and emotional dimensions to this as well. And a lot of it involves with what I was talking about before with the meditative process, but a lot of it involves this internal exploration. And this is something that I experienced when I was out at my family's farm. They weren't there. This was an empty farmhouse before I came there. And so I was out there and there's no neighbors around. I mean, there are neighbors technically, but you know, they're 5 minutes down the road, right? So you're physically cut off from the rest of the world. And I think immediately this triggers some sort of internal exploration. And when I look back at that time, it's interesting the things that I became focused on. The first thing was I was walking outside one day and I heard this, you know, this terrific sound. It was a very, very loud sound. And around the house, there are these different things called shelter belts, which are rows of trees that were planted to prevent erosion after the Dust Bowl. But anyway, there's all these rows of trees, very densely packed trees that are meant to be wind cover, and thousands and thousands of baby red-winged blackbirds had descended into the trees one day, and it was just so incredibly loud, and there was so many of them. And I walked out into the trees, and they didn't take off. They didn't really have any fear of me at all. And I just looked up at these thousands and thousands of red-winged blackbirds all chirping away at each other. And I don't know what they were doing, migrating somewhere, or they were just born. I have no idea. But this would have been in like late March, early April for all you bird dorks out there. But in my research, which means I Googled something, but in my research, I also discovered birdwatching became very popular over the lockdowns. A lot of people started looking at nature more and more. This was not an uncommon experience that a lot of people have. So in a sense, this isolation will create, you know, especially if you're involved in some sort of solitary creation process, I think nature is something that's going to bubble up very, very quickly. And we see it in a lot of different artists where their isolation leads to a fascination, a deep examination of their relationship with nature itself. But I think that isolation obviously can go beyond this idea of physical isolation where you're separated from society itself. Because somebody can feel completely isolated while living in New York City, right? They can be surrounded by all the art in the world and all the people in the world, and they can still be in their own world. They can still feel extreme loneliness, and they can feel isolation from the rest of society. In the artwork making process, this creative process that people engage in itself is always kind of an isolated act, unless you're, of course, you know, collaborating with a group of other artists or some institution or something like this. But oftentimes, these artists are coming up with these ideas. They're making things nobody ever asked them to make, and they're choosing their own pathway. And this can often be a big problem for artists who are just starting out because they don't know where are they supposed to latch on to. What idea do they care about? That can often be the biggest stumbling block for artists who are just getting started. Whereas somebody who's, you know, isolated mentally from the environment which they're in, they could still be laser focused on one subject. And that in itself can result in the creation of some really fantastic work. And again, I'll give a second disclaimer. This is not the best way to be an artist, right? If you want to be an artist, being thrown from society and on your own, or going away to slave away in a garret somewhere, is not the best way to be an artist. I'll say that. But it made a lot of really great art. It really did. It made tons of great art throughout the years. This persona, and this is something that bugs me, because in all of academia, or, you know, art-related academia, the idea of the genius working alone is hated. People hate this notion right now, especially with institutions having more and more power and, you know, institutions wanting to be part of the conversation with the community and with other artists and all this sort of stuff. They hate the idea that somebody's out there by themselves. They're not listening to, you know, whatever. They're not listening to this podcast. They're not reading Art Forum or any of that. They're creating by themselves, and they're making art based on their own introspection itself, right? And we have countless examples of this throughout history. I'm living in Prague, in Czech Republic, which is the home of Franz Kafka, often considered, you know, one of the greatest and most important novelists of the 20th century, and somebody who was also deeply isolated in many, many different ways. You know, first of all, he spoke German. He was Jewish, and he lived in Prague. So this was a place that was predominantly Czech-speaking, and it was hostile to Jews. So there was a cultural and linguistic barrier, both for Kafka, and this likely spurred his feelings of detachment for the society around him. Then he had this psychotic father who was completely domineering and abusive and totally unsupportive. And, you know, Kafka documented all this in his letters, and he often expresses his own feelings of inadequacy and fear. And this domineering asshole of a father clearly impacted his own psychological well-being that led to his isolation as well. And then on top of everything else, Kafka had these chronic health problems, including tuberculosis. And this is another type of isolation we commonly see, where people with health issues, you know, they're kind of thought of as outside of society, or they're not part of everything that is happening. And of course, we should all take measures to, you know, help them in any way possible and integrate them into society. And there's laws that protect this now, thankfully. But 70, 80 years ago, or 100 years ago now, I guess, this was not the case. So, you know, Kafka's chronic health problems ultimately killed him in the end, you know, but it led to a physical and emotional isolation. It was another way of him being an other. And this illness often kept him away from work, social activities, and it would force him into these long periods of confinement, which also happens with people with health issues, especially back then. You get stuck in a hospital, you're by yourself all the time, right? You have a family visit or whatever, but you're not going to the corner store to buy some orange juice. And this comes out in his writing, of course. You know, the most obvious being The Metamorphosis, and, you know, where a man, Gregor Samsa, wakes up and he's a cockroach. And this transformation is a metaphor for Gregor's extreme alienation and isolation from both his family and society. And everybody is repulsed by the way he looks. What is a more isolated character than Gregor Samsa? Nobody's on his side. And while Kafka depicted isolation through these surreal and abstract scenarios, which kind of highlighted his existential angst against society and family and everything, there's other artists who offer a more personal approach that is grounded in their own physical and emotional pain. And somebody I think highlights this very well would be Frida Kahlo. And a lot of her isolation also stemmed from physical ailments, so similar to Franz Kafka in this regard. And she also had these very problematic and tumultuous personal relationships, mainly with Diego Rivera, who she was married to. And there's certainly a lot of abuse, emotional abuse, and these sorts of things involved in that relationship as well. And these health issues, you know, she got polio at the age of 6, and this left Frida with a limp her entire life. So she was set apart from the get-go as walking different, right? We all think like, oh, I didn't know this show and everybody made fun of me or whatever it is when you were in first grade. She had to go into that same period of her life, literally the way you walk, everywhere you go, she's marked as somebody who is an other, right? And this would create a sense of isolation and a sense of introspection and who she was. Then later on, when she was 18 years old, she gets into this terrible bus accident where, you know, she breaks her spine, her pelvis is shattered, and she has all these fractures. And this, you know, puts her into the hospital. She's isolated in the hospital itself, and she does a lot of paintings about this process as well. But let's think of the difference between Kahlo and Kafka. Kafka kind of raged more broadly at society itself, whereas Kahlo looked inward and examined her own personal isolation in her work. So her paintings themselves are an examination of this bus accident, right? She makes paintings about this bus accident where you can see like this metal pole kind of like jammed into her body. So Kahlo's paintings are rich with imagery of both isolation and loneliness. And she often uses her physical and emotional pain as motifs in her work. So when she's creating her self-portraits, she's got all these great self-portraits throughout the years, and they make up a substantial portion of her work. And she's often depicted alone by herself, and she has to reflect on her pain and her emotional suffering. We can look at the painting titled The Broken Column. Look that up on your phones or whatever. And in this painting, she portrays herself with her spine exposed, and it's been replaced by this broken column. It's piercing her body with nails, encapsulating her enduring physical agony and emotional isolation. But she also uses all these symbols, and there's certain symbolic imagery which also points to a type of isolation, in my opinion. And she'd use symbols like monkeys, thorns, barriers, and she would often portray themes of protection, but also separation. So we can look at the painting Self-Portrait with Thorn Necklace and Hummingbird. Look that one up. And the thorns are choking her neck. And this could be interpreted like a metaphor for the pain and isolation she obviously felt, right? It could relate to Rivera and their relationship, or it could relate to suffering from her physical condition, but her neck has thorns all around it. In the case of Frida Kahlo, while she was, you know, deeply connected to her Mexican heritage, she also felt isolated in the sense she was of mixed heritage. And most people don't know this, but her father was German. And, you know, German had a specific different approach, obviously, being raised in this family that made her slightly not Mexican, right? Obviously, we think of her as this great Mexican artist and all this sort of thing, but she's raised in a household that is half German, right? So her art kind of defiantly incorporates both indigenous Mexican cultural themes as well as these feminist motifs, and it also challenges conventional norms of expressing a form of cultural and gender-based isolation. Of course, that's why everybody likes her now. Looking back, they see her as more of a genius than she was then. Of course, I think there was an article written about her that was like, Diego Rivera's wife likes to paint, right? Referring to somebody as the wife of, not exactly the best start there. Nonetheless, Kahlo is somebody firmly embedded within the art world. She's married to Diego Rivera, a very well-known painter, and she's having shows, and she's talking to people, and her father is connected to the bourgeoisie, for lack of a better term, in the area. And she's not isolated. She's not somebody living outside of society, right? But her own psychological state and place in the world is what isolated her. And this is becoming, you know, I have no quantitative research to back this up, disclaimer there, but it seems like we're currently living in a situation where often the world is becoming more and more connected, yet people feel more and more isolated. It's this type of digital isolation that a lot of people are living in today. And people are fearing, of course, that it'll get worse with the rise of things like AI girlfriends and boyfriends and these sorts of things, where the metaverse begins to clash with reality. And of course, social media and even this podcast, and you are listening to me, we have some sort of parasocial relationship going on. I'm in your ear right now for some reason, right? We exist in this world that's consumed by all these different personalities that we're not necessarily getting in contact with face to face. We're not getting beers together down at the local pub or these sort of things. And this leads to what is often referred to as a type of superficial connection to people that lacks depth. And oftentimes interactions in digital environments that includes, you know, social media and gaming communities and these sorts of things can often be very superficial. You know, there's a limited type of communication involved, even using text to talk to each other, and now just using emojis to emote to each other. It's, you know, lacking the depth of an actual real conversation that you would have in real life. And there's also a lot of these transient relationships. You know, many relationships online are temporary. You know, they're situation specific. If you're, you know, posting something on Reddit to some random on the internet, that relationship, that conversation, you two people are actually having a conversation, whether you believe it or not. When you post something on Reddit and somebody replies to you and then you reply to their post, that's a conversation that's occurring. And these relationships are situation specific and transient in nature. They're not something you're going to build on. You're not going to think about what you said to each other and a week later go and get another beer together and be like, you know, I was thinking about that and I kind of changed my mind. Well, the idea of changing your mind now is also impossible. But in the digital world, there's also this anonymity that is present. Going back to the Reddit analogy, there's a sort of identity concealment where people are hiding their real selves. They want to be anonymous, right? They want, this gives them this sort of freedom to experiment with their identity, experiment with their ideas, and they can, you know, engage in all these types of activities, but who are they talking to? Is that not yet another form of isolation? While we can be talking all the time and reading and commenting and doing all these sorts of things, isn't at its core that another form of digital isolation that's kind of akin to these other types of isolations, which I've been speaking about so much? And, you know, there's definite psychological effects of this, just as we have psychological effects for being stuck at a farmhouse and then you start paying attention to the red-winged blackbirds that come through, right? And thinking about them more. You know, another thing that people did throughout the lockdowns that I read about was they started collecting rocks. A lot of these places, you know, on beaches and these sort of places, they had to actually say, hey, please stop taking the rocks, because so many people were going out and they were all taking the rocks because they're all thinking about, oh, look at this rock. I like this rock, right? And, you know, they go home and they're having these piles of rocks. What are you doing with all these rocks? It's a manifestation of your interaction with the world and trying to find meaning within the world. That's why you have a pile of rocks at home, right? And similarly, there's these psychological effects of online behavior as well. There can be, you know, cyberbullying and this sort of toxic negative interaction that can come and is linked to this sort of anonymity. But when we think of anonymity itself, is that also not another form of isolation in a sense? And this concept of digital isolation is something that, of course, has also been investigated by artists as well. Most notably would be the artist La Turbo Avedon. And this is an artist that's kept themselves anonymous. We don't know who they are, but they refer to themselves as an artist and curator. And it isn't just a digital persona, right? They are, they're creating different projects, and these projects challenge our perceptions of space and identity in the digital age. And when we think about an avatar is the person curating this show, or an avatar is the person making the artwork. It's not a mistake that Avedon worked with the artist Hatsune Miku, who is a well-known Japanese pop star who travels the world as a hologram and plays for, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people probably, as a hologram. And there's a certain type of that comes with this, right? We don't really like this idea. The human is gone. This is an avatar curating a show. We're going to a concert to see a hologram perform. What's more isolating than that? The artist has been completely removed, and we've replaced them with a hologram. And recently, there was a show that Hatsune Miku played, and instead of bringing the hologram, I don't know why they didn't bring the hologram, if it was too expensive or something, but instead of bringing the hologram to perform in front of the audience, they just used a huge LCD screen. So Hatsune was flat on the screen. And everybody in the audience got really angry about this. They're like, we paid for Hatsune Miku. Hatsune Miku is a hologram. They'd constructed their idea of who Hatsune Miku was being a hologram. And when they came to the concert and they didn't see the hologram, they're like, wait a minute, that's not Hatsune Miku. That's just a, you know, that's just a LCD screen. And at the core of this concept, La Turbo Avedon intersects with all of this perfectly, because their work really pioneers this concept of non-physical identity. We've removed the person itself, and we're just looking at these virtual spaces as an exploration of what it means to exist and create. And La Turbo's, you know, making work that is often visually striking, and, you know, it's not stupid, you know, it's not just eye candy. In this regard, it also has some intellectual rigor behind it. But the origins of La Turbo's avatar identity is really quite interesting if we get into it and we dig in just a little bit, because their identity itself is born out of these different digital realms, including the world, virtual world Second Life, which is basically this metaverse type of virtual reality environment where everybody just wanders around. There doesn't seem to be really any point to it. It's just kind of like the world, except you're an avatar. But La Turbo's persona also gets shaped and changes and gets refined through numerous profile creation processes. And this journey itself kind of highlights a shift towards embracing these digital platforms, not just as tools for artists, but as integral parts of our very social fabric and personal expression. Why does it matter that a person is behind that identity? Can we resonate as people with a digital persona? In the case of Avedon and Hatsune Miku, I think the answer is obviously yes. However, at the same time, another thing we learned from the lockdowns is that people really like going to see people play, right? They want to go to the concert. When they go to the concert, Hatsune Miku was maybe the borderline. Maybe we don't get beyond that in the next 100 years, right? Because when they first came out with records, everybody was like, well, looks like there's not going to be any more concerts, right? When they first came out with photography, everybody was like, well, I guess that's it for painting then. And similarly today, with the creation of all these AI-generated images and all these sorts of things, that people are like, well, I guess that's it for artists, right? And we're coming right up to that boundary, right up to that boundary, and it relates directly to these ideas of isolation because it relates to people's ability to resonate with other people and the messages which they are trying to speak about. And all of this might seem very, very new, but it's absolutely not new. And if there's one thing I want you to take away from listening to this podcast, is that this concept of isolation and reflection and loneliness is something that has been present in the art world for centuries and centuries now. A lot of it bubbles up, a lot of it becomes known during surrealism, right? And we look at the expansive landscapes of these surrealist painters like Dali or de Chirico. And these surreal landscapes are kind of similar to what we see in the creation of these virtual worlds like Second Life. There's an emptiness. There's an isolation involved. It forces us to look inward, to think about our own introspection, to think about our own dreams, to think about our place in the world. That's the environment that's being portrayed in surrealism, and that's also the environment that's being portrayed in a lot of these virtual worlds today. So there's a thread that goes through all of this. A lot of it, it's not, you know, when we talked about Kafka as well, I think Metamorphosis was published around 1915 or so. But it's not a mistake that this introspection is linked to that time period. And while this became even more prevalent in the 1920s with the rise of surrealism and these sorts of things, the archetype of the artist as a lone creator separated from the mainstream has evolved over centuries and centuries before that. A lot of it comes from romanticism. And with romanticism, it was first focused on nature. A lot of that introspection looked directly to nature itself. And we had people like Caspar David Friedrich who embodied this type of idea. And then we came up to this urban isolation, which could be similar to this digital isolation, which we're seeing today. So with the rise of the urban isolation, we get people like Kafka who are raised in cities like Prague, yet they still feel completely isolated. That's very different from being isolated out in nature, being outside of society itself. And then today, we have the rise of this digital isolation, where we're more connected and communicative than ever before in history, yet a lot of people feel isolated from one another. So when we're looking at any artwork or any artist dealing with themes relating to isolation, I think it's important to take in the entire history of artists and their own experience with isolation and how it's impacted their work and how it's impacted the viewer who's also reading the work itself. Thanks a lot for listening, everybody. If you're into this sort of thing, head on over to Oko.academy, which is my tiny art school in Prague, where I teach painting, I mentor students, and you can come to Prague. You can come to Prague and study with me in my tiny little art school. Shoot me a message, and let's make it happen. And as always, happy painting.